This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Stephen McGid. Dr. McGid's the Chief Medical Information. He's also in charge of quality coordination at HSS. HSS is one of the most magnificent systems in the country. Top in orthopedics for the last 11 years or so, is ranked by U.S. News and World Report. It's simply a magnificent institution. Thrilled to get a chance to talk to Dr. McGid today about sort of the role of CMIO, how systems stay great and become great, and a lot more. Dr. McGid, can you take a moment and tell us about your role, both in quality and Chief Medical Information Officer, and then we'll talk about where you're focused for this year and a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to. So I actually started my career at the Hospital for Special Surgery, I think, probably in 1972 when I wrote my first paper in the HSS library in the first year of medical school. So I've been with the HSS my entire career. I did my internship residency and trained in rheumatology, where I did a whole bunch of clinical medicine for decades and became involved in perioperative medicine. And then as it became clear that we needed to implement an electronic record, we were sort of best of class 20 years ago, and we implemented first one record, then another. The CIO came to me and said, you know, we need somebody to help with the implementation and the change management. And so I said, you know, I know nothing about IT. And he said, perfect, because this is not about IT. It's about really change management. So I sort of fell into IT. The more I got involved in IT, I'd always been involved in quality, redoing the quality, along with many others, redoing the quality structure probably about 15, 20 years ago, and chaired, starting then and to this day, something called the Quality Coordinating Committee, the QCC. And as I became CMIO, it became abundantly clear that metrics and information drives and should drive quality in addition to a whole bunch of other things. So that's sort of my career trajectory and how I became involved in quality and safety and its interrelationship between being a CMIO and quality.
Thank you. And take a moment and sort of, I mean, what a magnificent career. Well, take a moment and sort of HSS, because you've been there for a long time. You've watched it become better and better. Talk a little bit about how that happens. How does an institution become constantly improving and get better and better? Yeah. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a real privilege to be here and for so long. And again, I can't speak from experience to compare it against anything because I have no experience elsewhere. But what's clear to me is that the people who are hired are the best and the brightest and really are passionate about what they do. So what it caused HSS, founded in, you know, in the Civil War era, to be great and remain great, they're the same things. You have to hire the best and the brightest. You need to be involved in research, teaching, and in clinical work. They're so interdependent and require and push us to the next level. If you don't do research, you don't understand what's important and you know, on the cutting edge. If you don't teach, you don't keep yourself on the cutting edge. And if you're not holding yourself to high standards clinically, then you're nowhere. But the other two points, other than sort of getting the right people, having the right culture, is you need to be metric driven, because you could think you're doing a great job and you're not, or you could be measuring the wrong things. And I think that's something we have through the years been much more attuned to. And that's, of course, integrally related with what IT and CMIOs and CIOs do. And the other thing is never be satisfied with the status quo. In other words, what worked and what we considered a great goal a year ago is not a great goal now and shouldn't be necessarily. So we're sort of always raising the bar and our expectations.
But it's a great thought process around constantly hiring the best and brightest, constantly looking at the right things, the right quality, the right key metrics, and never being satisfied, constantly wanting to get better, which is challenging and not easy. It's a great thought process and way of approaching things, and it's led to great success there. Take a moment on when you think about the role of CMIO, Chief Medical Information Officer, what are you most focused on and excited about as you look at this next year?
Yeah, I think survival is number one. COVID has sucked the air out of the room for everybody. And so COVID is really, really interesting, and that has to be an area of focus. There are all sorts of granular things you have to do day to day in terms of reporting to registries, making sure new drugs are on formularies. So we just have, thankfully, a new drug just became available over the last few weeks. Sort of all these day-to-day things, getting shots in arms, making sure that we're doing all the things necessary to keep our people safe and at work. But also there's a larger thing related to COVID over the next year, and it's a change in how we operate, right? Not all of us are sitting at our desks anymore. Some of us are doing telemedicine. Others of us are working from home in IT. So the whole, we're really focused on how to optimize the experiences that we have gained from COVID and not let it change our culture and to strike some sort of balance between work from home and in office. And that's, you know, you don't typically think of a CMIO as being somebody who is necessarily concerned with culture, but if you're not concerned with that, then you're not really doing your job. Other things related to the upcoming year, we've had a very, very smooth transition with the first parts of the 21st Century Cures Act and all its attendant other pieces. And so we were very successful in implementing the first few phases. And as you probably know now, the entire electronic medical record or data set is now going to be made available to patients. So that whole technical issues related to getting every last detail of the defined record set to patients and also having the workflows to support it and also the culture to support it when the patients really get more and more of their record, which is really, I think, critical to good care. So the 21st Century Cures Act. We're an epic organization, and it's a really never-ending story, which I think is a really good thing, because no matter what electronic record you use, if you're not consistently optimizing, training your team, both new and old folks, with new functionality. So there's a lot related to using the system in a better way every year. And I think they hold themselves to high standards, and they get better every year also. A couple of other things. Do you want me to keep going?
Give us a couple more thoughts. It's great. It's great. Yeah. Then I want to ask you a couple of questions about being a doctor. And let me let you go on for a couple more moments, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about being a doctor today. Somebody's taking their MCAT, say, would you tell them to go to med school? Yeah, would you tell them, oh, my God, no, find a new career?
I have
you know, what advice would you have for young doctors, stuff like that?
I have a lot of stuff to say about that. But so the other a few things, there's some really interesting governance issues that comes up related to IT. And one of the things that we're embarking on now is what's called an enterprise radiology or imaging governance. You know, it used to be back in the day, you'd wait your turn in a line to go to a light box in the radiology department, and they would put up your films, and that would be it. But now imaging is part and parcel of what we do all the time. And the whole concept of, we'll take ultrasound, for example. I mean, our musculoskeletal radiology ultrasound people or imaging ultrasound people are the tops, you know, bar none. And they use the top of line equipment and, you know, it goes into the PAC system. And there's a phenomenal amount of research and work that goes with that. But quite frankly, at 4 in the morning, if I have to tap a joint that I can't get into, a small joint, I'm going to want to use whatever handheld ultrasound at the point of care I might have. Who trains me? What? Where does that ultrasound go? How do we make sure that I'm compliant and that these images are stored properly and don't take up unneeded space in the PAC system or whatever it happens to be? So that whole concept of, you know, what standards should we use? Who should be trained to do it? What are the minimum training standards? All that is really interesting to me. And how do you protect the patient's privacy? And then finally, the whole idea of documentation and a note bloat. The coding rules have fostered a whole culture of putting in as many things as you can in the note, and it's to the detriment of the readership and those who read the notes. So the whole idea of having new coding rules that govern what really needs to be in a note, they've been loosened up considerably. And we need to make our documentation reflect both the new E&M coding rules, but also what's proper and best for patients.
But your point there is so important, because getting to the core of what's really needed for a patient, another caregiver, another provider, for when someone they come back to notes, is so important versus note bloat. It reminds me of the old days. You know, it's the old Mark Twain, concept of, I could have written a shorter letter, but it would have taken more time.
I love that quote.
It's more, brevity is the essence of wit, because it's more thoughtful to actually hit, here's what's important, here's what's not. It's easier just to catalog everything. And I've not heard it called note bloat, but I love that. One final question, Dr. McGid. You know, a young person going to med school today, would you tell them to go? Would you tell them not to go? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have personal experience with this, and at the risk of embarrassing my family members, I had to have a daughter who spent a decade in Africa doing refugee work and public health, and she had two masters, and really saw some of the worst things you could possibly imagine. And she saw a child fall out of a tree, reaching for a bird for the family's dinner, and he succumbed to his head injury. And she said, I never want to be in that position again. So after 10 years in Africa, two masters, she came back to the States, went through post-bac, went through med school, and now is an emergency room doctor in the same emergency room that I worked in 40 years ago. It's a calling. It's one of the most noble things you could possibly do in life. I think it's evolved clearly since I've trained, where it was sort of, a survival after 4 days on and one day off. It clearly has evolved, but more people are applying to medical school now than ever before, which is stunning, because, you read how many people are leaving the field. I think we clearly need to have our eyes on the causes of burnout. And I'm actually working with on a huge project related to altering our mandatory training for physicians, because that's a cause of burnout. So we clearly have to recognize the problems. And it's not all the EHR. In fact, I think it's now a much lesser part of it. We need to sort of address those incredible inefficiencies that are in our system that require us to, prior authorizations, and just the whole concept of the amount of administrative paperwork we do, that needs to be addressed. But it's really amazing that despite the number of people leaving the profession, the number of students in medical school and applications is going up. So that's a wonderful thing. And medicine is exploding. I mean, the concept of an mRNA vaccine made within a year, 10 years ago, when I was trained, would be unheard of. And so there's so many opportunities on the horizon for physician scientists and public health, I think, and information technology. I think it's one of the greatest things that somebody could do.
Well, just magnificent, and so many interesting things there. We'd love to pick up with you on another podcast. Number one, congratulations, and what an amazing job your daughter did in becoming a doctor as a second career. Simply amazing. And then two, so many other issues there about opportunities in medicine, about there not being enough medical school spots given and graduate spots given the number of doctors we need. I know that it's something like 50,000 apply, 20,000 get in, and there's just not nearly enough doctors being created, quite frankly. And not enough GME spots and everything, and maybe shortening the GME track, or how do we make it easier for people to become doctors? It's become literally an inverse problem, a serious problem.
Yeah.
Dr. McGinn, I want to thank you for joining us today on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. What a pleasure to visit with you and hear your thoughts.
It's been my pleasure, and I think I've already expressed to you how much I enjoy reading your daily email. So it's been a pleasure, too.
Thank you so much. What a great institution and a great leader, Dr. Stephen McGinn. Thank you so much. And more importantly, the younger Dr. McGinn deserves our credit.
Yeah, I think we're all pretty proud. Both of my daughters, too. My other one's in public health. And so we're all, and my wife's a doc. So we're pretty blessed with a medical family. So.
That is simply remarkable. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.